Podcasts from the Cochrane Library, the latest evidence for healthcare decision-making.
Hello, I'm Peter Tugwell, a practicing clinician, and I hold the Canada Research Chair in Health Equity. This is a podcast of the Canadian Collaboration for Immigrant and Refugee Health Guidelines.
Dr. Grant is full of energy today, and he's going to need it, judging from the number of people in the waiting room. Although he engages in public debate about the shortage of family doctors in Canada, privately, he takes some satisfaction from a crowded waiting room. It keeps him on his toes, and it makes him feel valued. After seeing a dozen patients with the flu, in comes 18-year-old Abdi, a Somali who arrived in Canada on his own a year ago after spending 2 years in a refugee camp. Abdi complains of recurrent abdominal pain and is worried that something is seriously wrong with his stomach. Dr. Grant asks him how school is going, and Abdi tells him that he tries to work hard, but he is doing poorly in his studies. When Dr. Grant asks how he is sleeping, Abdi responds that he spends about 10 hours in bed every night, but doesn't sleep well. He dreads falling asleep, in fact, because of his frequent nightmares. He doesn't feel sad, he says, but he isn't interested in things and avoids going out with his friends because of his pain. Dr. Grant begins to suspect that Abdi's stomachache represents more than just a physical complaint.
Professor Lawrence Kiermaier is the first author of the evidence review on depression of the Canadian Collaboration for Immigrant and Refugee Health. Dr. Kiermaier, what's wrong with this patient? What it's only having abdominal pain?
Well, it's very common for people to present in primary care with pain, fatigue, other non-specific somatic symptoms. And in the majority of cases, there is not a clear biological basis or a clear physical disease that accounts for this. After investigations, sometimes physicians conclude that there's nothing really going on and they just want to kind of dismiss the patient. But we know that a significant proportion of patients who present with complaints like abdominal pain or muscular pain and so on may have a concurrent major depression.
Why is that happen? Why this mental problem is presented as a physical problem?
Well, it's probably intrinsic to the nature of depression that it increases one's sensitivity to pain, it causes increased muscle tension, it disturbs gut motility, it probably has a variety of physiological effects, and both peripherally and centrally, and that results in pain. Probably 90 to 100% of people with severe depressions have some form of physical pain. The issue really is how much does the patient pay attention to that, how much emphasis do they give to that in their mode of presenting to the clinician.
So that is something that affects all the population, or it's a problem specific for immigrants and refugees?
We know that it's something that affects the population in general. A study we did here in Montreal some years ago showed that the majority of people with major depression actually present in primary care mainly with physical symptoms. It's only a minority of people who come, whatever their background, and talk about being depressed and talk about that being their central problem. The issue for newcomers is that because of language and cultural differences, because of unfamiliarity with our healthcare system, they may be much less likely to also mention the depression, anxiety, other kinds of emotional symptoms that give the clinician clues that there might be a major depression going on.
And it could be a problem if the physician is pointing to them that this could be a mental problem?
Labeling it as a mental problem or a psychiatric problem can be very difficult for people, partly because people from most parts of the world come from places where there are healthcare systems in which psychiatry or mental health only deals with the most severely ill. So their notion of what a mental health problem is somebody who is very severely disabled with a chronic condition, really disorganized in their behavior and so on. Mental health doesn't include, in many parts of the world, mental health services at least, don't include our broad definition of problems that include things like depression, anxiety, and so on. So as a result, mental health and psychiatry are highly stigmatized in most people's minds.
So then how we can deal with that, how we can fight this stigma, how we should present information if we suspect that it could be a mental problem?
Well, part of it, I think, is working within the framework that the patient themselves has. If they feel fatigued or they feel pain, it's a perfectly legitimate strategy to help them understand the nature of that fatigue and pain. And if one feels that it's a major depression, to frame that as a physical condition that does lead to energy depletion, that leads to chronic pain and so on. And various kinds of treatment can be given, psychosocial or medication treatment, framed around those issues. At the same time, most patients will acknowledge that their mood and their mental state interacts with their bodily feelings. That is to say, it can make things worse. And so that becomes a way to introduce the idea of using various strategies to control symptoms and to feel better.
So in these cases that there is a language barrier and so on, do we need to do an extra effort? It's legitimate to ask for help. How we should approach these kind of cases?
Well, I think it's absolutely essential when there is a language barrier or language major language difference between the clinician and the patient to make special efforts. Well, one thing we've suggested is that people take advantage of the existing screening measures that are available in many different languages. And some of those are available online through a web resource that we've created, so that you can use a simple, for patients who are literate, you can use a simple screening tool to get a sense of what might be going on. But most importantly, in clinical encounter, if there is significant language barrier, it's important to use interpreters. And those interpreters need to be professionally trained interpreters. Using somebody from within the family, a child or other family member, is not adequate and indeed can be a serious impediment to getting good information.
Dr. Kirchmayr, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
There are four key points to remember regarding depression in immigrant and refugee patients. Number one, new immigrants to Canada show lower rates of depression than the general population, but these rates generally rise to match the general population rate over time. Prevalence of depression in refugees is comparable to that in the general population. Number two, existing guidelines for depression for the general population are likely to apply to immigrants and refugees. These guidelines suggest that all patients should be screened for depression when integrated systems are in place to provide follow-up treatment. Number three, primary care for immigrants should provide descriptive materials regarding depressive disorder in relevant languages, translated screening questions, and trained interpreters to facilitate the diagnostic interview, and systematic inquiries about losses, stressors, and symptoms. Number four, mild depressive symptoms should be treated with education and self-management techniques with follow-up to assess resolution. Moderate to severe cases should be treated with a step care model, beginning with psychoeducation and antidepressant medication, close follow-up, and culturally appropriate counseling. This is a podcast of the Canadian Collaboration for Immigrant and Refugee Health, produced in cooperation with the Canadian Medical Association Journal and the Cochrane Equity Methods Group.